Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore. Stephen Nafe and Gregory White-Smith graduated from Harvard Law School. Mr. Nafe, who has written for art periodicals and worked at the National Gallery of Art, studied art history at Princeton and did his graduate work in fine arts at the Fogg Art Museum of Harvard University. Mr. Smith, who majored in English literature at Colby College, studied medieval and Renaissance music as a Watson Fellow in Europe and did graduate work at Harvard while serving as the assistant conductor of the Harvard Glee Club. Together, they have written many books on art and other subjects, including four New York Times bestsellers. Their biography, Jackson Pollock, An American Saga, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1991 and was a finalist for the National Book Award. They join us tonight to present their extraordinary new biography, Van Gogh, The Life, a book that was more than a decade in the making and represents the work of over 20 translators and researchers who had unprecedented access to the Van Gogh Museum's archive. We're delighted that Steve and Greg are with us this evening. Would you please join me in making them feel welcome?
Thank you very much for having us. I'm Greg, by the way.
And I'm Steve. Well, Greg, I'll, why don't you start?
Steve and I met, you heard that we went to law school. We met the first day of law school in 1974. And we had three things in common. We loved books, and particularly biography. We loved the arts. Steve was and is an artist himself, and had done training in art history, and I was more into music. And we both knew that we didn't want to be lawyers. So we naturally gravitated to each other. And by the time we graduated from law school, we had written our first book. And then we went to New York and started to write, basically supporting ourselves by writing. And that would meant we did a number of things that I would, you know, as Phil Donahue said when we wrote a book for him for his series, he said, you wouldn't want to throw in your grave, you know. But we also were able to start in 1981. The biography of Jackson Pollock, which took us 8 years, published I think in the late 1989, then when that won the Pulitzer in 1991, we thought, well, who are we going to do next? What's our next subject going to be? And there were sort of three considerations. One was that we wanted to do another artist, obviously, but the question was the art significant enough to warrant a big, you know, 900-page book? Two, was the life interesting enough to support that kind of treatment? And you'd be surprised how much great art has been made by really essentially boring people. That's unkind. It's an insular activity. Therefore,
we looked at actually as we were completing Van Gogh and began to think about what next. We thought this is sort of getting the story in reverse, but we thought about how nice it would be to be working on an American artist and looked through the Pantheon, and Winslow Homer moved around a lot, but other than being in motion for a fairly long life, the life itself isn't all that interesting. With both Pollock and with Van Gogh, we had these two titans in the history of art who were also marvelously complicated and interesting.
We have a dynamic working relationship. We made a wish list basically, and at the top of that we thought, who would, if we could do a biography of any artist ever in any country, any time, who would we do? And we actually thought about Michelangelo, but the top of the wish list was Vincent Van Gogh. And, Vincent Van Gogh is Vincent Van Gogh. He occupies a stratum of cultural... he occupies a cultural status that no other artist does, really. There are images like Da Vinci's Last Supper, Michelangelo's Creation of Adam, things like that, that are sort of singular images. But in terms of a career and a persona and a body of work, there's nobody at Van Gogh's level.
Meaning that there's no other artist who is known by people who are 5 years old and people who are at the end of their lives and everybody in between and in every corner of the globe. Yeah. In Zimbabwe and in Uruguay and in Croatia, everywhere in the world, Vincent Van Gogh is popular. So the sort of universality and the sort of agelessness of his art is at least for
immortality,
for an icon of serious art. There are popular artists. I'm not sure that our demographic is all that aware of Lady Gaga. So
I don't think they're that. Nor I'm sure is it worth a whole. Anyway, the third factor was the killer. The third factor was, has it been done? Has somebody already done the definitive biography? So when we thought of Van Gogh, we thought, oh, surely somebody's done the definitive biography. Surely. Steve knew something about it and couldn't think of any biography that really fit that description. And then we did our initial research and found that there had not, in fact, been a definitive biography of Vincent Van Gogh. So we thought, well, this is our guy. This is clearly the next book. And we just sort of... as it turned out, naively waded into this ocean of information.
We sort of wondered. We mentioned to Charles here from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, and let me say it's a real honor to be here. We've been in the book business for a long time, and Greg's actually spoken here before, on a different book and a different store. If you're in the book writing business, the Tattered Cover is really one of probably. I would say there are really only two nationally famous independent stores, this and Politics and Prose, and they really are at the top of the list of independent bookstores, and we're tremendously honored to be here. The problem with Van Gogh was the obvious one, and that was that we didn't speak Dutch.
Oh, yeah.
And I was going to actually say why. When we jumped into Pollock, it was interesting that it was a very small, tight little community of people. It was not. He would only have been 70 when we wrote the book, and so there were people who had written books about him who had known him, and then really the feeling was, how could you possibly write about Pollock if you didn't know him? Yeah. And when actually knowing somebody is really can be an impediment to writing a biography. Robert Caro did it with Moses, Robert Moses, but that took a whole lot of courage to do that. But with Van Gogh, the problem was language and the sort of mountain of work. When we began, there was a remarkable level of warm embrace, really, from the other Van Gogh, from the Van Gogh scholars, even though our credentials didn't include Van Gogh, and we wondered really why everybody was so friendly when we were sort of trying to grab this golden ring, and one very major Van Gogh scholar said, "We all looked at you with
recently said
we all looked at you with sort of dumbfounded that you were willing to take this on. Those of us who were in the field knew that this was an absurdly large topic, and none of us wanted to do it. We were thrilled and relieved that somebody who was out there was naive enough to actually want to wade into this vast deep ocean of material." But back to the language problems, we imagine it a little bit like somebody who speaks only Lithuanian showing up at the Library of Congress determined to do the definitive biography of Abraham Lincoln. So there we show up at the Van Gogh Museum speaking not a word of Dutch, and it's really a tough language. And they were remarkably welcoming, and basically the feeling was, if you can do it, great, and we'll help you any way we can. And we solved the problem by hiring 11 translators, because even though Van Gogh's own letters, which are marvelous, and some of you may have read them, they're really great works of literature, had been translated elegantly by his sister-in-law, Joanna Bonger, into English, but all the family letters, which had never really been tapped. I mean, there were people within the Van Gogh Museum who had access to them, but nobody had gone through them systematically. And because Van Gogh was the problem child, as with Jackson Pollock, the family letters are all about these two famous people, not because they're famous, but because they're all, what on earth are we going to do with Jackson, or what on earth are we going to do with Vincent now? You can't believe what he did now, and you know, how can we get him committed? The family letters are incredibly rich with the family's perspective on Vincent, even as he is writing voluminously to Theo about what's going on in his head. But there's also a secondary literature of that we had to absorb, of things like Dutch reading habits in the 19th century, or very relevant to Vincent van Gogh, prostitution in the Netherlands in the 19th century. And those books are only in Dutch. And beyond that, so that's where the 11 translators came in. And we literally had them translate not just the family letters and the other key primary sources, but entire books of secondary literature.
Yeah, the other challenge that we didn't really foresee was that Vincent not only wrote voluminously, roughly 1,000 letters to his brother, and then there was this additional, almost the same number of letters between family members, between Theo and his various siblings and his parents, that had not been used. But Vincent also read voluminously. We would all, the industry would benefit hugely if there were a few more Vincents around. He would read, a book a day kind of thing. And he would read a novel by Balzac and think, oh, I like this author. And then read all the Balzac. And read he read in German, French, Dutch, and English. And wrote in all three. And he read poetry, and he read novels in particular. He loved Shakespeare, read all of Shakespeare multiple times, and read all of Dickens, whom he loved, multiple times, and Balzac and Zola and...
but the German Romantic poets.
And Uhlen and Schiller, and just this incredible list of books that he read and reread. And so... our feeling was that we sort of came to this gradually, as this mountain loomed in front of us, that if we were really going to understand the product of this imagination, we were going to have to understand everything that went into his imagination. So that meant reading everything he read. It meant looking up and looking at all the pictures he knew, pictures in the sense of either not photographs but paintings, which he referred to as pictures, but prints and various other things that he visually, that sort of, he had a tremendous memory. He had a phenomenal memory. So he could summon up images and paintings, the glare off a painting, the depth of a black, the tonalities of from a painting he'd seen 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so all you knew, all that stuff was in there, in that head, the whole time. So we sort of felt, well, we really have to, if we're really going to do what we plan to do, if we really are going to do a definitive biography, we have to understand that whole universe that was informing the images that he made. And this is interesting. His whole career, he died at the age of 37. His entire career as an artist was the last 10 years of his life. And almost all of the great images that we all know, sunflowers, Starry Night, the San Remi, the wheat reapers and the wheat fields and the and that sort of thing. All that stuff comes from almost just the last 2 years of his life.
Yeah, well, one of the questions that you constantly ask yourself in thinking about him is, what if he lived 2 more years or 5 more years or 10 more years? Because the quality of the work doesn't abate. It just gets better and better. It just gets better and better, and it leads in all kinds of new and interesting directions. It becomes more, it almost reaches full, complete abstraction. So you desperately want to know. You know, Mozart completed so much, but with him too, you wonder, what if he lived to be 80? You know, what would the vast corpus of work have looked like had these two people that lived beyond their 30s?
Well, the other challenge for a biographer was that so much of what was the sort of the payoff was so short. You know, those last 2 years, to understand those 2 years, both and what came out of those 2 years, both as a biographer and as a reader, you really have to know everything that came before. So, you know, he wanted to be a preacher. First, he wanted to be a dealer, an art dealer, like his uncle, who was a very famous and prominent art dealer. Then he wanted to be a preacher, like his father. And he went through this long, very grueling religious phase. And then he basically finally wanted to be an illustrator. He entered the art with the aspiration to be an illustrator, to do black and white drawings for magazines and etchings and things. So, you know, the man we think of as the giant of color, the greatest colorist of all time, there was a time when he argued Theo furiously that the greatest art was all black and white. And they went through just these relentless arguments in the letters about Theo kept saying, you know, you really ought to try color, and maybe you ought to look at these guys they call the Impressionists, because they're doing some interesting things. And Vincent would write back angrily, oh, it's terrible, it's just awful, I just hate that stuff. All that light is just so fake, it's so unreal. The real truth lies in black and white imagery. So my point is, all that... That 35 years really was necessary to understand it, and because all of it was retained, as it is for all of us, in that brain, in that imagination, and then in this incandescent burst of productivity in the last 2 years of his life, was it all came out on canvas. So to really understand those images, we really felt not only did we have to understand what came before, but we had to tell the reader what all those things that came before.
Well, maybe the other biggest hurdle, other than the sheer mountain of material, was how to handle that just physically. With Pollock, we had 20,000 note cards, and we literally they weren't index cards. We had what the IBM told the world was the absolute last word in electronics, and that was a digital display writer, which would print out every letter
one at a time.
You know, they told us we'd never have to buy another machine again. And so we printed out these note cards, but there were 20,000 of them, and then just made stacks throughout the apartment, first part of the life, second part of the life, third part of the life, and did them basically the way we used to do term papers with index cards. And the problem with this was that because it was possible, we ended up with a gigantic amount of information on paper. Actually, it was digital. What we did is we scanned this entire literature into a computer, and we had an IT team write a software that would allow us to create digital note cards and then to create a digital outline and drag the cards into that digital outline, which had the enormous benefit of tying each card to its source just automatically. It meant that if you wanted a card in two places, you could just copy it. If you thought the outline was misshapen in some way and wanted to rearrange it, you could just do it electronically and everything would move with it. And then in the writing process, you could call up all that data, not physically, which would have taken a room as big as this, with just stacks of notebooks full of cards, but it was all there in a computer, making it really physically possible to handle this much information.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons that we ended up with 28,000 footnotes is because we could. You know, we could track the information. We knew where everything came from, and so it made it possible. Unfortunately, it didn't make it printable. So we, you know, Random House, understandably, the book was already coming in at 900 plus pages, and the idea of printing 5,000 pages of notes was not something that our editor was really excited about. So, and that was perfectly understandable. But thanks to the internet, we were able to create a website, and we worked with the University of South Carolina, and their humanities department has a sort of new digital process or digital department or whatever.
It's called the Center for Digitizing the humanities, which is made to order for what we were doing.
Yeah. So we worked with them and created this website, vangobiography.com, which is free, and we were able to print everything. Not only were we able to print 28,000 notes, but some of which are, you know, as I say, it's like 5,000 pages, typewritten pages. But also to put in far more illustrations than we could put in a book. All of the black and white illustrations that are in the book are there in color online. A number of additional illustrations, all the illustrations of works that Vincent knew or mentioned by other artists are online. Additional photographs, historic photographs, photographs of places where he lived, all in the same place. So it's an incredible resource. And I think that Van Gogh is the perfect subject for this kind of multimedia presentation, because he had this fascinating life. He was incredibly literary. The most interesting story of a life that I've ever read or seen, and it's incredibly elusive.
Not necessarily our book, but the
yeah,
subject
no,
matter.
No, I mean the story. Yeah, the story. It's just, you know, he cut off his ear, and everybody knows the story in its broadest outline. He cut off his ear, and supposedly he committed suicide. They know that. They think they know that. And he was just the perfect, and his images were so elusive. He was constantly, and you know that because we have this vast number of letters from him, so where he talks about his creative process. And we know that he had this image in mind or that image in mind, or he had this book in mind or that book in mind. So it was all there, and so what the internet allows us to do is to supplement the story with all that sort of background information, all that layering, so people can see additional things that it would just be unwieldy to try to put into a one-volume biography. But I was going to say, really the biggest challenge, and it sort of relates to what I just said, and I didn't plan it this way, and that is that the biggest challenge was the fact that he was so well-known. Or, you know, there was this mythology about Van Gogh that everyone sort of had a piece of. Mostly the things I just mentioned, the cutting his ear off, which is I'm sure the most famous self mutilation in art history, and maybe in history. I can't think of another self mutilation in history. You're the history guy.
Well, there are some self mutilations in literature,
in the Bible,
in Zola. But
anyway, the point is, it's people just know it. And if they know nothing else about Van Gogh, they know that he cut off his ear, or they know about the artist that cut off his ear. And then, of course, there was the suicide. But I think the ear is – anyway, they have this idea of the biography, and they have this mythology of this tormented genius, unrecognized, ignored in his own time. And he exits the world and then becomes a huge celebrity and has these phenomenal auction prices and these long lines around his exhibitions. And this really came home to us when we went to Auvers. You want to?
Yeah, some of you may have actually been to Auvers, which is where he's buried. And almost 500,000 people a year go to visit his gravesite. And they leave mementos of themselves. Once a day they have to go through and clean up the gravesite, because artists will have left their paintbrushes or tubes of paint, or people will leave notes to Vincent van Gogh. Russians pour vodka on the grave, which apparently is a tradition in Russia, a way of commemorating the dead. Jewish visitors put rocks or stones on the tombstones. But most astonishingly, Japanese visitors will bring the ashes of their ancestors to pour on the grave of Vincent van Gogh so that they can live throughout eternity with the painter of Starry Night. And it is, when we say that he occupies a unique status, it really, only if you veer off into popular culture and Elvis Presley do you get that kind of sort of involvement with a figure.
I would actually go past that. We noticed as we did this, and we sort of went to places like that, these places of pilgrimage, essentially. The asylum, the cemetery, particularly the grave, and even the Van Gogh Museum, where the phenomenal collection, that there really is a sort of religious thing going on. It's more than just admiration or liking the paintings. There's a kind of devotional thing going on. And that was obviously a tremendous opportunity as a biographer, but also a tremendous challenge as a biographer, because you really want to present a full three-dimensional person when you write a biography, and get past that incredibly facade or that image that icon that is in everybody's head.
Well, I think even though it was a challenge to sort of look behind the mythology, it was enormously helpful to us that people knew not only the basic outline of the life, but know the art, because it meant that we could devote a huge amount of material to the period before he achieves greatness as an artist, and that we suspected and hoped, and it's fortunately been proven, and now that the book is out there and people are reading it, that people would not only be patient, but actually eager to read about this difficult, challenging, completely unproductive, and unsatisfying life, because you keep wondering, how is all of this loneliness, this misery, this failure going to finally erupt into something that's world-shattering and that achieves a permanent place in the human heart? Even with Jackson Pollock, he may be a really important American painter, but very few people knew the outlines of the story, and they sort of know the images, but not with the sort of, they didn't hang them in their dorm rooms in college. They don't have them on postcards and refrigerator magnets. There isn't the same sort of sense of personal connection that made it possible to do what we really like doing most. Actually, we haven't talked about this in any of the previous talks, and that is trying to understand why people are the way they are, yeah, is really sort of what drove us to all this.
That's what actually originally attracted us both to biography. Long before we actually wrote a biography, we read them because it was just interesting to us why people are the way they are. Why do they act the way they do? Why do they take the directions they take in their lives? Mm-hmm. And so that was really something that was in us before we got to actually doing it.
We want to take questions and answers momentarily, so let us address one of the sort of one of the aspects of the mythology that's not really true, and that is that he didn't become famous after he died. He actually became famous just before he died, in the sense that it happened in some ways the same reasons it happened to Jackson Pollock, and that was the art and the times basically came together. Greg, why don't you address what was happening in the cultural zeitgeist of Europe at the time?
Well, let me set it up just a little bit. He spent, as you sort of either know or can infer from what we've said so far, that he spent a long time fighting his own, his inner demons, and fighting his own, his brother, in finding his art, and rejected the Impressionists and rejected color for a long time, gradually embraced them, and tried color. He believed deeply in complementary color, but took it to extremes that were unknown at the time. No one else was doing the same thing. And people laughed at his art. Cesse de rire was one of the expressions that was used when he had some paintings on show.
And his own mother, if you've begun the book, you know this, even though she died 17 years after he did, and he was really very well known by the time she died, to the very bitter end, she considered his art ridiculous.
Yeah, she insisted it was ridiculous. And anyway, during his whole early career, up until we talked about those last 2 years, he was off doing his own thing. He was, committed himself to an asylum and made these paintings that were really quite shocking to people at the time. We're so used to them. We see them in exhibitions and we see them illustrated. And, you know, we see, oh, my God, it's a Van Gogh. Isn't it beautiful? But at the time, the colors were so intense. And the drawing was so free. The shapes were so personal. That people thought it was really weird and shocking, and he was doing his own thing basically,
and not in
a good
way.
People didn't take it seriously. So, but what was in the meantime, while he was off in the south of France, wrestling his demons, the world was changing. I mean, radically changing in a fairly short time. First of all, what really triggered that was the War of 1870, Franco-Prussian War, which really underscored and brought to the surface a terrible sense of malaise that had been building throughout the century, and a disillusionment with the bourgeois conventionality that had really had built the whole civilization up to that point. And it was reflected in the Salon system, which was the jury system where every year that you would submit you'd submit paintings by artists, and a jury would select particular paintings, give it a prize, and then the artist would go on to sell lots of prints as well as lots of paintings and found an atelier and train other painters. And it was all very sort of hierarchical. And that was just a cultural reflection of the whole society, basically, and the culture. But in the meantime, people were becoming increasingly disillusioned with religion. Even in Holland, church attendance was off dramatically toward the end of the 19th century. They were trying to cope with tremendous changes in technology, scientific developments in astronomy and biology and disease, understanding of diseases, and just everything was shifting. The whole world was shifting beneath them. Well, as usual, artists were sort of the canaries in the mine shaft in this regard. And so very early in the 1860s, I guess you would say, the Impressionists came along and said, well, art really shouldn't be about the salon. It should be about the science of how light is reflected off surfaces. And so that was where the Impressionist contribution was, in their way of trying to cope with these changes, these vast changes in the zeitgeist. And then came along the Neo-Impressionists, who wanted to be even more scientific and argued that there were optical rules in how you processed images. And therefore, if you broke the light up into small pieces and the color up into tiny dots, that it would register in the eye in a way that would give you a more accurate view of the actual image, a truer and more authentic kind of reality. And then, in the 70s and 80s, even another group of artists came along that was even more disenchanted and more disillusioned with the way things were, and they roughly come under the category of symbolists. And they said, listen, art, you're all barking up the wrong tree. Art is not about science. Art is not about hierarchy. It's not about what you see. Art is all about what you feel. Art is about what's inside. It's about the sensations. It isn't about the object that you're looking at, whether it's a still life or a portrait or a landscape. It's about how you react to that image. And so what the art needs to do is capture that emotion, that sensation. So it became all about sensation and about the essence of what it was. And they considered sensation the essence of being human. And the mission of art was to capture that essence in some way, whether it was literature, whether it was art. And so anyway, so what you see, and I hope you can do, I've laid the groundwork well enough, you can see that the world was swinging Vincent's way. So suddenly in 1890, basically there's a critic named Albert Aurier who said, wait a second, if that's what art's really about, if it's about emotion, it's about authenticity, it's about inner feelings, there's this crazy guy in the south, this crazy Dutchman in the south of France, and he's in an asylum. And so he's really in touch with his inner feelings. No, seriously, I mean, I'm making it slightly light, but that's exactly what happened. And so he wrote this fabulous article in an important art journal saying, this is what we've been looking for. This is the Messiah. This is the guy. And this is the art. And so there was just this, his reputation went off like a bottle rocket.
And you have to imagine his reaction to all this. Yeah. He's sitting there.
This was January 1890.
He died
6 months before he died.
Yeah, 6 months before he died. He's sitting there completely lonely, surrounded by crazy people, because his own psychotic episodes were episodic. He was quite lucid between them. And even though he found the other patients charming when he first arrived, by that point he'd lost patience with the others there. And his own family didn't visit him at all. The only time anyone came south was when he cut his ear off and Theo came down for less than a day. And so he feels completely abandoned by not only the world, certainly, but even by his own family. And all of a sudden, in Paris, people are talking about him as the greatest living artist.
Yeah, and Monet said, "This is the star."
Yeah,
this
Monet star. Even was saw his some paintings that had been submitted to an exhibition in Brussels, and came away saying, "There's something really, really interesting going on in this painter that many of us have never seen before." And what's really Vincent had no idea how to react to this, and it's really both it's really touching that he had decided to help justify his failure, that people who succeed become incredibly unhappy.
Artists.
That success brings with it terrors that are unimaginable to those of us who haven't achieved it. And he thought, my gosh, if I'm this miserable now, when I'm unsuccessful, what levels of misery are achievable out there beyond failure? In fact, when he sort of collected himself enough to react, he wrote a desperate letter to Aurier saying, "You've got it all wrong. I'm not the great artist. Paul Gauguin is the one you should be looking at." Because we spent 10 years working on this, we could talk forever, but we'd rather answer any questions that you might have.
Let's answer questions.
Ma'am.
I'm wondering what happens to the mementos that are put on the grave. Do they gather them up and put them somewhere?
They do collect them. The question is, what happens to the mementos on the gravesite that when they clean it up every day? The ones that look significant, meaning the notes that have substance or any objects that look significant, they do collect. Some of those are saved at the Institut Van Gogh in Auvers. The Van Gogh Museum itself also has a huge collection of memorabilia, basically, surrounding Van Gogh.
They call it ephemera. Van Gogh ephemera.
But it's a daunting task to both keep it orderly and to save the sort of serious items there.
Other questions?
Ma'am.
With 10 years of research, what was the most amazing thing or what shocked you the most that you found out? Something that you hadn't known before.
The question is, in 10 years, the 10 years we spent on this book, what surprised us the most or amazed us the most? Is that a fair?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I think
how big the job was.
Yeah.
That was the first amazing thing.
We were certainly astonished by the level of his intellect. I mean, the level of his intellect will, I think, if you haven't read the book yet, is really a dazzling. I mean, at his best in his own writings, it reaches at least at the level of George Eliot, which is a very, very, very high level, and maybe even to the level of Shakespeare occasionally. I mean, it's really that good. And to realize that this mind was not only capable of these staggering images that have iconic places, I mean, in our hearts and our minds, but that he was capable of this kind of thinking, both about art and about literature and about existence and about God and about the hereafter and all kinds of topics of Wagner's music. I mean, the range of his intellect is really astonishing. Certainly, the most worrisomely
surprising,
because we knew it might overshadow the book itself, was the fact that the traditional story of his suicide just didn't make any sense, and that actually, it's interesting, when we first began, well, it's had a trajectory of, even in the months since the book came out, we've noticed that first of all, the Van Gogh Museum didn't quite know how to handle it, so they issued
the alternate
theory, which we probably should go into for people who may not have noticed this, the 500 articles that appeared in the media, including a half hour on national Chinese television about Vincent Van Gogh not killing himself. And the Van Gogh Museum sort of distanced itself from it, even though people within the... We were not the only people who were uncomfortable with this theory.
With the theory that he killed himself.
That he killed himself. I mean, in 2006, a scholar at the Van Gogh Museum had gone to his colleagues and said, I've looked at the medical evidence, and given the angle of the trajectory of the bullet, and given the doctor's description of the entry wound, it just doesn't seem possible that he could have been the one who pulled the trigger. But this guy hadn't read all of the literature. I mean, the benefit we had is that we set the task of reading everything, no matter how mediocre. We weren't just reading the really good books on Van Gogh. We were reading even the terrible books on Van Gogh. And you never know where an important fact might lodge itself in the midst of an otherwise unimpressive piece of work. He just couldn't imagine who would kill Vincent Van Gogh. Why would anyone kill Vincent Van Gogh? And he posited, well, there were duels in France, but who would get into a duel with Vincent Van Gogh? None of it made sense. But the medical evidence didn't comport with a suicide. But there were a lot of other dozens of other details that didn't quite make sense to us and to many others in the field. The fact that he supposedly died in the wheat fields, which is a mile away from the Auberge Ravoux, and it's up a very dramatic escarpment, and he had this terrible wound in his abdomen. Just how physically could he make it down that escarpment and get to the Auberge Ravoux? You know, the drama as portrayed by Irving Stone, who really sort of crystallized the mythology, and then it was embedded in the movie Lust for Life, has him painting this great meditation on death, the crows in the wheat field, and he's out and he's got the gun to scare off the crows. But it turns out, there were no crows in Auvers in July. B, we knew that he was a bird lover from childhood. He collected their eggs and he collected their nests, and he was very comfortable around birds. He would never have needed to scare the crows off. And he felt no discomfort, as many painters. No, painters did not feel a need to actually see birds in order to add them into their paintings as a subject matter. And the painting was painted around July 10th, which is more than 2 weeks before he died. And in the interim, he painted a lot of very happy paintings. And there was a very unhappy letter that he wrote to Theo, which he never posted. But after it, he wrote a rather joyful letter to Theo, and in which he asked for a whole lot of paint to be sent. It didn't make sense that he would go out painting in the afternoon with the decision that after, sort of in the middle of the work, he would just pull out a gun and kill himself. It just didn't make any sense.
It's so dramatic.
Also, less than 2% of the people who kill themselves with a gun do it in the chest or the abdomen, and even a smaller percentage do it in the abdomen. They basically do it in the obvious place where it's going to actually end life immediately and as painlessly as possible. This wound lasted for more than 24 hours. He lived, and it was a terribly painful way to die. But then these other details emerged. You look at the medical evidence and the fact that the wound, the trajectory of the bullet was from an odd angle and from perhaps, as the doctor at the time said, too far out for Vincent to, he didn't
have shot himself.
And then in 1956, this, if you've seen the 60 Minutes piece, you've heard the sort of basics of this, but a man who became a rather wealthy banker and a businessman named René Secretin, whose father was a wealthy pharmacist, and they summered in Auvers, which was sort of like the Hamptons at the time. It was where wealthy Parisians went to spend the summer. And he and his elder brother, Gaston, who became a cabaret singer, befriended, although that's a weird to use the word, this crazy Dutchman. Gaston really did befriend him. Gaston wanted to be sort of an artist, and he actually, one reason that Vincent gravitated to them is A, he was lonely, as he always was, and B, Gaston engaged him in conversation about the Paris art world. But René, who was 16 at the time, was a rowdy teenager and had bought a Buffalo Bill costume at the Universal Exposition the year before. It was the biggest selling item at that. In fact, this is one minor footnote in history, is that somebody else who bought a costume was Paul Gauguin, and when he came off the boat in Tahiti, he was wearing his Buffalo Bill costume. But he had this malfunctioning pistol. That was the other part of the evidence, is where did Vincent get this gun? Who would have given this guy who had just come out of an insane asylum a gun? It just, that never made any sense. And where was it? Why did no one ever find it? And he admits in this 1956 interview that it was his gun.
Secretin
does.
René Secretin admits.
That it was his gun, and he doesn't admit to pulling a trigger. But he was a relatively smart guy. He knew that there was no statute of limitations on murder, and it was. But it's an incredibly guilt-ridden, longish.
You're making the mistake that a lot of the media has made. We do not.
It's
argue.
A very dynamic relationship we have here.
We do not argue that it was murder. It was symptomatic of the media, especially the American media, because the foreign media has not made this mistake. We present an alternate theory that he was shot accidentally in some sort of altercation with this 16-year-old René Secretin, who had a pistol, and they often drank a lot, and Vincent often got angry, and René often teased him. So
in rather brutal ways.
You can think of many combinations of that set of circumstances that could create a gunshot. But we never say that there was a murder involved. Murder requires intentionality. You have to want to kill somebody. What's new is that we also say there's not a suicide. And that if when Vincent left the inn where he was staying with his paint, and he took his bag of paints and equipment and his easel and his canvases on that day in July of 1890, he intended to come back. He didn't go out intending to shoot himself. So therefore, there was no suicide either. It is true that he ended up with a gunshot wound. And we have this other theory that's fully argued in an appendix in the book, that with all this material and more, and it takes up like 10 pages. The book is 950 pages. But of course, in some of the American media, it's author's report Vincent murdered.
But actually, one of the other details, and actually, if there was one moment in this massive research that was really sort of took us our breaths away, was the report that John Rewald, the greatest art historian of Impressionism and Post-Impressionism in the 20th century, who was studying in France in the 1930s, went to Auvers and talked to the villagers, because in the 1930s, there were people who had been alive 40 years earlier when Van Gogh died. And the rumor that was circulating in the village was that Van Gogh didn't kill himself, that he died accidentally in an altercation with a couple of boys, and that he decided to accept the blame for this and act the martyr. And so that was the story that was being told in Auvers, and it matched remarkably this interview given in 1956 by somebody who lived far from Auvers, who had only been there that summer in 1890. So it was all those pieces coming together, and what we've seen over the last month is a kind of shift in the among the sort of serious Van Gogh scholars that this alternate version of the death seems more plausible to them than the one that was sort of canonized by Irving Stone, who was admittedly writing a work of fiction, not a biography.
We don't want to intimidate you from asking questions by answering them at such length. So we promise we'll be briefer in our answers.
Sir.
Sir.
I don't doubt that at the end of his life he was psychotic, but I wonder if you came across any evidence that he had some other medical conditions, like a seizure disorder or migraine headaches, where auras of these might have led to some of the images that he ended up putting down on the canvas.
The question was about Van Gogh's... a bit parenthetically, and I promise to be brief. And for those who don't know, and probably some of you do, that Van Gogh is pronounced originally in Holland, Van Gogh. Both of the G's are guttural in G-O-G-H. So it's some people think just one is, but it's Van Gogh. And it's pronounced differently in different parts of Holland, but don't worry about that. And we just use Van Gogh because it's easy. The question was about his disease, about his mental affliction, and did it affect his imagery? Is that a fair summary? What was his mental state and his physical health, and how might that have affected his art?
We think, and I think the consensus of Van Gogh scholars who have addressed the issue of his mental illness agree that his own doctors had the right diagnosis for his principal mental problem. Actually, he had multiple ones, to your point. But his own doctors thought he had epilepsy, and not only that he had not only epilepsy generally, but a specific form of epilepsy, which in the West, in English, we call temporal lobe epilepsy, which is different from grand mal epilepsy. And in the general, it might be a psychiatrist, I'm guessing. I'm out of my depth here a little bit, but we've certainly read the literature on this. Vincent is such a star that people who treat mental illnesses, many of them have wanted Vincent to have whatever it is they specifically have an expertise in. So there have been lots of diagnoses over time. But if you look at the registration intake forms at the asylum, it's written very clearly epilepsy, and there were a lot of epileptics in his family. The form of the TLE has seizures and psychotic episodes. It's a terrifying disease because during the psychotic episodes you blank out. You don't after it's over you don't remember the time during which you're having this episode. So you basically in terms of your identity, it's terrifying.
Yeah, it affects. And, it is an unusual discharge in the brain of neural activity in the part of the brain that controls some higher brain functions, in particular memory, comprehension, and the sort of things that affects your sense of identity. So it's a common symptom is you have hallucinations, oral hallucinations, visual hallucinations, and Vince did report having such things. You often think you see yourself in other people, or you see yourself moving in ways you don't, or you don't associate yourself with some actions that you take. You think they were taken by someone else, or someone that's invisible, or someone else in the room. It's a terrifying disease. You can have multiple attacks in a day, or there can be months between an attack. We know from his letters when he had attacks and at least had some of them, the ones he reported to Theo. We may not have reported them all, but we know when the major ones were, and he would be out painting, and Mistral would come and blow his painting gear away, and he'd just blank out, and he'd wake up back in the hospital. So it was now whether or not the second part of your question was, did it affect his art? I don't think there's no evidence to suggest that he painted during any of these seizures. There are some paintings that in my opinion, and I think our opinion, reflect the kind of mental, especially the emotional, the nostalgia is probably the best way to say it, the sort of the overwhelming power of things recollected. And so he did a whole series called Recollections of Noonan, Recollections of Holland. And in the middle of all these colorful paintings from Saint-Remy, there's this strange, ghostly series of greenish paintings that were from his homeland and of his memories of his own youth. And I think that's, you know, falls into the category of the kinds of paintings you're talking about. But I would want to say this, and I'll try to make it short. I think that the most direct way, and this is touchy territory, as you can imagine, art historians don't want to talk about his illness in the same breath as his paintings, because they think they're afraid that people will see the paintings as somehow the product of an unbalanced mind. And our response to that would be, the paintings are the product of his whole life, and his illness was a part of that life. So to that extent, yes, it's true that his paintings were about his illness, but I think it's unfair to go so far as to say that the paintings are a product of the illness.
One of the ways we do think the illness had an effect on the way his paintings emerge is that around temporal lobe epilepsy, and let me parenthetically say, we think he was bipolar, not just we, but doctors who've looked at the record, and he had gastrointestinal problems, and he had a whole lot of other issues, including the fact that he didn't eat very well. He would go for months living on coffee and bread, and so there were a lot of medical issues in his life.
And alcohol.
Lots of alcohol, too much alcohol. But he... there's a collection of personality traits that accumulate around somebody who has temporal lobe epilepsy, and they help. They're almost a roadmap to his personality. Just to pick two of the most important ones, one of them is a kind of argumentativeness. And Theo describes how arguing with Vincent was just absolutely impossible. He would hammer at you until he just argued you into complete exhaustion and submission. At which point, when you sort of conceded that he was right, he would take your point of view and then argue into submission again. But he also has something that psychiatrists calls viscosity, which I think in lay language means that he was sort of smothering, meaning he would attach himself to somebody who really he didn't know very well and try to sort of bring them into his life in an overwhelming way. It happened so intensely with Paul Gauguin that the minute he arrived in Arles, he wanted to get out of there. Because the combination of that smothering intensity of involvement and that incredible argumentativeness, you can imagine what an unpleasant combination that would be, and why he would not be the person you would choose to go on a long vacation with. But it also meant that he couldn't really work with other painters. The Impressionists worked as a group. Picasso and Braque developed analytical cubism together so in such companionship that there are a couple of paintings that they afterwards couldn't quite decide which one of them had painted the painting. Well, Vincent created this unbelievably interdirected, incredibly individualistic art, setting up the paradigm for art after him. Partly because he was so alienated and such a loner, and his psychological conditions made him a loner, and being a loner set the conditions for being the kind of artist he was. So the effects were
the illness shaped his life, which shaped his art.
Rather than painting directly things that he saw during a seizure, because we really don't. As with Jackson Pollock, who was a staggering alcoholic, never painted anything when he was drunk.
We do think, though, that two images haunted him from seizures in the one part of his latter part of his time in Saint-Remy, and they were both religious images. He was really very intensely haunted by religion and the issues of immortality. Anyway, I hope that answers your question. Yeah,
ma'am.
Ma'am.
I'm just curious. So looking at the artist process, because you're saying that he was one of the first people to have lines that free in his art and very unstructured.
Right. Right.
How did art historians figure out what sort of process he used to in painting and stuff? Like, did he write about it in his letters and stuff, or
Yeah, he does write about the artistic process, but there's a wonderful, if any of you saw the 60, the question is, how do we know about his artistic process? Is there evidence in the letters about it? And I urge you, even if you don't watch the 60 Minutes piece, and it has nothing to do with Greg or me or our book, they're not even mentioned, but they did a CBS Overtime in which Morley Safer is digitally inserted into, I don't know if any of you, did anybody here see this thing on CBS's website? It's really magical. It's so poetic and so lovely. They digitally put Morley, who has a huge, unbelievable gravitas, partly because he just turned 80 and partly because he's been such a sort of, you know, elder statesman of journalism for so many decades, and he's a painter himself, so he loves the subject matter. They situate him digitally inside in some of his most famous paintings.
Van Gogh's most famous paintings.
And they have him just reading passages from Van Gogh's letters about that painting. So we do know intensely. One of the things that made this subject so rich for us was, you know, to be able to portray the development of an imagination. With Pollock, who said almost nothing, and he sent a few notes, postcards mostly, he sent me three cans of black enamel paint, to have these 700 voluminous letters in which, in many of them, he describes what he's painting, why he's painting it, why he's choosing the colors, what the colors mean emotionally. Because he's the most studied artist in history, he's the most thoroughly examined artist, we can reconstruct the process of making the paintings, because the conservators have written books about, you know, there's a layer of white, and then there's a blue layer, and then the green came after that. We can actually describe the process in which the paint was applied to the canvas because of these unbelievable conservation reports. With Van Gogh, one of the really interesting things is really true of Pollock as well, and that is that with Picasso, he gets to abstraction after he's proven to the world that he can draw with like an angel. You know, he could draw with the perfection of Ingres or Degas from a very early age. Really, I mean, his father, when he was, I think, 5 or 6 years old, his father was an artist, said, "This, my son draws better than I do." And so when he got to abstraction, there was no sense that he was sort of using abstraction because he couldn't paint or draw technically, academically. With both Pollock and with Van Gogh, neither one of them had what we think of as traditional academic drawing skills. In fact, Pollock was always at the bottom of his class as a draftsman, and Van Gogh never even could stay in school long enough to do it, and neither one of them ever had that skill. So both of them had to basically leapfrog over those issues of technical skill and come up with an art form that allowed their innate, is not popular these days, but it's really none of that applies adequately, and that's their innate genius to come out in these unbelievable paintings.
You go to the next question.
Next question. No, you had one, ma'am.
When you first started this project, what was your projected timeline?
Well, more importantly, our publisher's projected timeline was 600 pages in 2006. And
when did you know that wasn't going to happen?
By about 2001. So we played a game with ourselves. When do we tell them?
We didn't start writing. The question was about our projected timeline at the time we started. We didn't start writing until 2004.
Yeah.
So that was 4 years of purely reading and researching and organizing and thinking. And then we started writing in 2004. So, and then we had a number of interruptions, health interruptions, during that period. So it was pushed back an additional year or two for that reason.
But let me add that when we told our editor, the wonderful woman named Susanna Porter, that we would be a little bit late, and then we told her the second time, and then the third time, she was unbelievably understanding and gracious about it. And in fact, the publisher of Random House, Susan Camel, told us at lunch 2 weeks ago that they would have given us any number of extensions, anything we needed. We've never had had a house that was more supportive of us during this long process. And you can see the loving care in this beautiful object. I mean, since we didn't do it, I can praise it. Barbara Bachman, who did the, they asked us, the serendipity of this book is so astonishing. They asked us for recommendations for somebody of what kind of style we would like the interior pages to look like. And we ran through our library and picked out the Teddy Roosevelt biography because we thought it's about the right time period, and it's beautifully designed, and the use of the pictures is really, the photographs of Roosevelt are wonderful. And I didn't even look up the name of the designer, but we mentioned it to Susanna, and she said, that's perfect because Barbara Bachman, who designed the Teddy Roosevelt book, is our first choice to do the Van Gogh book. And they put enormous effort into picking this vellum that would make this sort of mysterious veiled image of Van Gogh. But I know we want to sign some books for some people, and we've taken up a lot of your time this evening, and we're really grateful that you would come out on what for us is a very cold evening and to join us here to discuss this this extraordinary person. Thank you all.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.